Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
This time we have a great guest. I love that we're able to have her on the show. It's Joan Mellon, who's written plenty of books, a PhD, a professor. Thank you, Joan, for taking the time to talk to me today.
It's a pleasure, Al. Looking forward.
So, I was looking, you've done a lot of books and you've done a lot of research surrounding JFK. What led you to do so much work centered around JFK?
Well, I decided to write a biography. I had been a biographer of other subjects, literary subjects, for example. Bob Knight, a basketball coach. And I decided to write a biography of Jim Garrison, whom I had met. And so the only way I could think of to get through the morass of controversy, because there was so many attacks on Jim Garrison, was to find out everything I could. And the National Archives, after the JFK film, had the FBI, CIA, and other agencies release their records on the Kennedy assassination after the film of JFK. And so I had to go to look at everything. What was actually there? What were the records of the Garrison office like? What kind of interviews did they do, and with whom? It was great fun. I spent a lot of time in Louisiana. I met Jim Garrison's classmates, everything. Oh, and one classmate of Jim Garrison's was named John Rarick, who was a very conservative, may I say, rest in peace, racist. And however, he liked Jim Garrison, and he also liked the law. He was a lawyer and a judge and a congressman. And he was adamant. Jim Garrison, as district attorney, had a lot of rape cases, but the women didn't want to come forward and testify. So one solution that they had was to put the perpetrator in this place, the East Louisiana State Hospital at Jackson, which was a mental hospital. And this was in John Rarick's constituency. He was up there in East Louisiana Parish. And he found out that some of the people who had been thrown in the insane asylum had not been given a fair trial, hadn't given any trial. And so John Rarick issued writs of habeas corpus and said, you let him out, or you try him. So eventually they did, and one of the prisoners is a particular rapist, which I discuss in one of my books. I wrote several books about Garrison.
Yeah.
One was a biography of his early life, his political life, his life in the army, his childhood. And the other was A Farewell to Justice, which is the one about the Kennedy assassination. So I enjoyed doing the first one because to see all these cases and that he followed as district attorney of Orleans Parish. And this story of Leonard Caesar, this very notorious figure who did a lot of rapes in the French Quarter, is very interesting because he finally did go on trial, and he said, I think his sentence was time served in the insane asylum. So he got out, and he drove, he managed to get himself to John Rarick's home in East Feliciana Parish, and he had with him a metal hammering, I guess, of a fish. John Rarick is on the roof, very populous figure. He's on the roof fixing his roof, and Leonard Caesar comes along and just hands it up to him, this plaque of a fish, which represents Christian charity. He was grateful to John for having brought his case into the light, really, and had let nature take its course. And I thought that was a symbol of Christian love and charity. And these are some of the things that happen in sort of very Louisiana, isn't it? And then when I started to, if you see it in Fantasy and Bargains, there's a long section on the attack on the USS Liberty during the Six-Day War. And I decided that I would, after that, my next book, which is I'm doing now, about the Liberty, I would include John Rarick, because he was one of the few congressmen in the United States who demanded that the truth be told, that the case be open, and that people and learn what actually happened on that day in June when Israel fired on the USS Liberty, an unarmed ship. It was a surveillance ship. It was not a battleship or warship of any kind. And they were, and then people just died. They died like flies. And I try to find out, well, what happened? Why did they do this? Did they do this on their own? Did they have a collaborator? Well, sure they did. Nobody would do that. These are unarmed American sailors. They had no interest in the Middle East. They were just sent out there to tap the cables for the Soviet messages. Not that they were of any interest. Finally, when the National Security Agency interviewed these people, and they said, did you learn any valuable intelligence from being out there in the East Mediterranean in a war zone? And every one of them had a say, and they were all military people. These are not radicals. They had to say they had gotten nothing out of it. They were sent up there to be attacked, like sitting ducks.
Yeah.
This is interesting to me. So,
yeah.
And John Rarick was a maverick. And so he got up in Congress and demanded that an investigation be carried out by the American government. Well, and to this day it hasn't happened. And this coming June is the 50th anniversary of the attack on the USS Liberty. So I'm sort of following, one book follows another. I don't think I did justice to the Liberty story. I told what happened in Faustian Bargains, but I didn't explain where the idea of this came from. It didn't just pop out of the sky.
Right.
And that's what I've been doing. It is not, it's very difficult, the most difficult research I've ever done.
Would you find that it's hard to find people that were around then or that are able to talk?
Well, I found, you know, there were still survivors who were on the ship, but they didn't know what happened. They knew they were shot, but they didn't really know how that came about. And I found some people, one of the most valuable people that I found was a person who was the head of State Department Intelligence and Research, Thomas Lowe Hughes. And he's in the Chevy Chase and very willing to talk, but not quite. I mean, he didn't show me his report. He had to write a report on the Liberty incident. He didn't show that to me. But he told me, I knew more than he did, of course, by this time.
Yeah.
But not everybody would support such a thing. And I also found out that the chief of naval operations at the time, who was Admiral McDonald, well, he's not alive anymore, but I found hidden papers and notations where he says, well, what was the ship doing? Who sent the ship up there? So then my task was to find out who it was, and I did. Miracle. But if you do this research enough, you just sit there and look at the papers and look at what is released. And what has been released by the government, National Security Agency, CIA, whomever, has been redacted. But they don't redact everything. Sometimes they miss a sentence. And that's a key sentence. You find out a lot like that. And you just go, eureka. But you're all alone upstairs in the, you know, at your desk, and you know you have no one to share it with.
Yeah.
But
do you find that it's when you do something like that and find something like that, are you worried about reaction? And I say that so much more because I find with the JFK and the assassinations and all the 60s, whenever we talk about events, there's a lot of passion and there's a lot of, you know, nastiness that goes on.
I know, but, you know, I've learned, see, I got a lot, I was the recipient of a lot of the hatred of Garrison. Because here I am writing a book supporting Garrison and telling what his story was, and I got hell. The New York Times wouldn't touch it. And so I hired a publicist, and she, innocent, she goes to the office of the editor of the New York Times Book Review. His name was Sam Tannenhaus. She schleps my manuscript in there. Well, she's thinking she'll get a review. She's trying hard. She's and they wouldn't look at it. They wouldn't touch it. And I know that, and not only that, but they have not reviewed any of the books I've written since. Like, I got a black mark, like a blacklist, and that goes for NPR. NPR is the twin of the New York Times. These go in bed together.
Yeah.
So I can't get on NPR, and I was so puzzled, because I was in Baltimore, it's not too far from here, and there was a good NPR show, I can't remember the name of the host, maybe he's still there. He just wouldn't have me on no matter what. I could lay down and die, he wouldn't do it. Why? It's because, you know, there's a. I think it's about Garrison, really. It wasn't me. It wasn't anything about me. Because it was clear that I was taking Garrison seriously.
Right. Well, can you talk to that? Like, what is the issue with Garrison in the way? I mean, I'm looking back at it, and I watch, like, the John Barber films, and I listen to all this. I've had plenty of interviews. What is the big. I mean, Garrison, I think, however you take it, whether you believed what he brought out in the trial against Clay Shaw or not, why is there such a negative impression of him?
Well, you know that the CIA has media assets. They have people that work for them that express their point of view. And one of them was about Garrison, Richard Helms, who was, I think, in 1967, he was the director of Central Intelligence. He came up with the view that Garrison is being manipulated by the KGB, and that's why he's accusing Shaw and all of this. Now, it just so happened, after the book was published, I find a document from the CIA review group, which says, of course, Clay Shaw was a highly paid asset of CIA. And I have the document, and I published it in my book about Haiti, but you can find it. It's not hard to find. Whoa! So they admitted it as they're looking through. See, they're reviewing the papers that they sent to the House Select Committee. And this is one of the things, they say that. Well, you see, Garrison, when he started to look at the summer of 1963 in New Orleans, and he sees Lee Harvey Oswald roaming around there, and Garrison comes out with and Garrison, as I said before, always wanting to come forward with what he finds. So he said, I look at Lee Harvey Oswald in the summer of 1963 in New Orleans, and I see everyone he's associated, not only was he never alone, because you know he had the thing, the lone assassin, not only was he never alone, but everyone he was with CIA. They went ballistic. And ever since then, Garrison is on their list, and years have gone by. You think they'd get over it. The footprints of CIA are everywhere in the New Orleans story. That's why when I came to Texas and I was working on Mack Wallace and Lyndon Johnson, I knew some of the people around the Texas story, whom you mentioned just a minute ago, think that the Kennedy assassination was a Texas story, Texas justice. But I know, because I know the CIA is roaming around there in that summer, that there's a big CIA footprint in the Kennedy assassination. So it couldn't have been just Texas or just Texans and Texas justice. That's just a myth. That's a false sponsor.
Right.
So they all yell at me and threaten me and all this, and I just don't care what they say. I have to tell you something, Al. Yeah. You know, these days, this is a very trying time. The society is being destabilized in a rapid way. I'm teaching at a university. I had a student get up in class on Valentine's Day and issue a tirade of venomous obscenities against women, against gays, against every which and against people who criticize Trump. And we were frightened. The girls in the class, you know, the young women, one of them wrote me an email and said she's afraid to cut a class again. This is upsetting. I said, I'll protect her, don't worry. But I can't protect her because you know that the university has no mechanism to punish a student that does this. It's anything goes these days. So the whole the social order is falling apart. And in keeping with that, we have this the undermining of the research into the Kennedy assassination. And that means that any people will make up lies, they'll say someone else is a liar, they have and things about how it's Texas Justice, for example, and LBJ did it. No proof of that whatsoever. Not one single iota of credible evidence. And they say that. And we're afraid. We can't be afraid of them.
Right, right.
Jim Garrison wasn't afraid. He went out and did, you know, they got him finally through undermining him, through harassment, through looting, causing him to lose the office of district attorney so he couldn't conduct his investigations any longer. But he did, and then he became ill and he died fairly young, but he never stopped. Till the day he died, he was still interested in what he said. The truth will come out. Even when the House Select Committee was corrupted, you know, the Church Committee, all these committees, he said the truth will come out. Yeah. And I think a lot of the truth has come out. It's just that there are forces that refuse to acknowledge that the truth has come out.
Do you think that's related to today's political climate?
Absolutely. Because if we were to really pursue the truth about the Kennedy assassination, one of the things that we would find is that lying and mendacity and in order to take power, really, you have to undermine the forces of reason, if I may use a phrase like that, and the research, and so confuse the issue, so blow smoke on the Kennedy assassination that people will just throw up their hands and say, well, who knows? We'll never know. You've heard that, I'm sure. We'll never know.
Yeah.
And we do know. We will know, and we do know. And because in order to pursue what they're pursuing, which is the endless war, I'm going to go into the war economy and all of that, they need to confuse the population so that they would actually vote against their interests. That's not the first time that people have voted against their interests. But this time they really did, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
They voted, but they had there was no one who represented their interests.
Right.
Either candidate. So
yeah.
It was a mess. I did not vote. I have to admit it to the world. I didn't vote. I couldn't. I could not vote for her.
Yeah. I think that was some of the problem. But I think that in the current climate of politics, a lot of that is, excuse me, back to that staging of creating someone. Sort of what they did to Garrison, they stage a lot of stuff that's not true.
Absolutely.
You know,
and who's going to know? And who's going to? And you know. So anyway, I'm coming out with this new book about the liberty, and I'm going to say what I think happened, and who decided, and where the idea came from. It's not that hard to find if you just open your mind and say, well, what could it possibly be? And there was a paper called Operation Northwoods that was written by Lyman Lemnitzer during the Kennedy years, in which it was a list of dirty tricks that the United States would do in order to get rid of Castro. That was their favorite pastime. And one of them was blowing up a ship, attacking a ship. Now, it went to McNamara. Well, McNamara was Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, too. And it went there. And then Kennedy vetoed it. He didn't want any part of it. But then it seemed that the idea hovered around, was in the air. And they said, well, you know, what the CIA has done dirty tricks, of course, since day one. And the CIA had a lot of power, especially in the Kennedy years. And they didn't like Kennedy one bit. and Kennedy didn't like them. You can see that in Richard Reeves' biography. It's called President Kennedy. It's the best biography of Kennedy. And he just has Kennedy saying, I'll get them if it's the way. I'll get those CIA bastards, if I could say that on the radio. If it's a, it's a quote from President Kennedy. If it's the last thing I do. Whoa. I mean, but they would do, they were making policy. And in fact, that the CIA was making policy is part of an a seven-part article, I think, that was printed in the New York Times on the front page during the Kennedy years. It was sort of an expose of CIA.
Right.
So, yeah.
I was going to say, but does this play into now? Because nowadays when people are talking about the Russian hacking and all these different things, there's a real distrust for CIA.
Well, CIA started the Cold War. Now, I don't know what they're saying now, no, yes, no, yes, but yeah. The fact is that if you look at the Alan Dulles years and the people they employed to, you know, rev up for anger against the Soviet Union, these were the people that in the Galen group, that this is the Secret Service of Hitler, and they came to the United States, and Alan Dulles embraced them, and he sent them off there to Russia to be spies for the United States. Whoa. And they were very much in favor of the Cold War against Russia.
Yeah.
And I don't see any credibility now myself. I don't really know enough, but what they did, why would they care for one candidate or other?
Right.
Same way I didn't.
Well, you know, that's just it. You know, and you know, when you look at it, whether it's true or not, either people or have no faith in their government and CIA, or they don't care.
I think they don't have faith in the CIA, and I think Garrison, finally, I think I have to say, beat them.
Yeah.
Because he created a distrust. And that's the most he could do. But that's a big thing to do. Because when we grew up, I don't know, maybe I'm older than you, kind of, but we trusted the government. We liked the government. We were proud of being Americans. Who ever heard of attacking Dulles?
Yeah.
But when you look at it, you look and see what's what, it's pretty bad. And so all my books are connected to these issues.
You know, something Jim Garrison said, it really holds, where he said, I thought I was still living in the country that I was born in.
And I love that.
Yeah, and that means a lot to me, because I almost feel disillusioned from what I grew up in the 60s and in the 50s and 60s. You think it was everything was good, like you said, love America, good government, good people were the good people of the world and all this stuff, freedom. But now as years go by and I do so many interviews and read so many books, I feel very disillusioned.
Well, Garrison did too. He went to the, he joined the FBI briefly. And then he had a choice to re-enlist in the FBI or go to war. He went. No, I think that was the second time. I take that back. He went into the Army, enlisted in the Army, in the Army Air Corps. So he was flying these little planes into the Germany and risking his life, thought nothing of it, and was present to witness the liberation of Dachau, was there, took pictures. And I put those pictures in the book that I did, Jim Garrison, His Life and Times. It was about his early life, his military life. That really governed his whole life after that. And he had been a patriotic American in every sense.
What did you think of him when you met him? What did you think?
He was into himself. You know, he was talking and talking. He didn't care what you said. He didn't care. He just talked and. But that's all right. He wanted to talk about what he was doing, which is the Kennedy investigation. Now, at that time, he had just lost the Shaw case. I saw him in May of 1969. The case was in January. Shaw was acquitted, and Jim Garrison didn't care. He said Clarence Darrow lost the Scopes case. And, you know, the case about Darwin.
Right.
And look, you know, implying that, you know, his view prevailed. And the same, he felt that his view would prevail. But he was passionate. obsessed. He didn't care about anything else. He had no political ambition whatsoever. People would try to accuse him of that. It wasn't true. And in fact, I was sick, and he came up to the room. My husband was there, and we were talking, and some people from who worked in the hotel were fixing the blinds. The sun was shining in my eyes, and they said, "Hello, Mr. Garrison." And I thought, well, how is that? All these black people are saying hello to Mr. Garrison. I had no idea he was district attorney. He never referred to it even. What did I know? And yet, all I knew was this is a person that's investigating the Kennedy assassination. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow.
And he went into this. He liked to stay, go to this restaurant, which was, God, I can't remember. It's in my books. But anyway, it's in the middle of the room. It had a very fancy place, and talk with a cigar and talk. And other times that I saw him, the last time I saw him, he came. We had dinner, and he came to my hotel. In the it was the Windsor Court Hotel, which is a wonderful hotel. It was before Katrina, and he would sit after dinner. He'd be sitting in the lobby, talking again at a table, and just it was nobody even noticed. Nobody. It was just a common sight.
Yeah.
You know, and he was a judge then. He was no longer district attorney.
Right.
But he was very interesting. This is an interesting person.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that time, he had been framed for taking bribes from pinball interests, gambling interests. It was illegal to pay off on pinball games. You could play pinball, but not pay off in a bar with a bartender, with money, change hands. And he was accused of taking bribes from the proprietors who owned the pinball machines. And it was a big deal. It was a federal case. And eventually he had F. Lee Bailey said, I'll represent you for free. But it turned out, finally, that Garrison defended himself. And he talked about his life. And he talked about what meant, ideas that meant things to him. And he got acquitted. But it had taken so much out of him,
right.
And he was so exhausted, and he had to run for re-election right then, and he lost to Harry Connick, which is the father of Harry Connick Jr., the musician.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was a big blow. He lost by 2,200 votes, not very much.
No.
And he didn't campaign. He refused to campaign. And all his young assistants would go out and try to campaign for him, but people wanted to see Mr. Garrison. And he was just, he'd had it.
Yeah.
He hated being a politician anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, I could see. I don't blame him. In Faustian Bargains, the book, you talk about Lyndon Johnson and Mack Wallace. So what is it that you find that's different than what most people think about the relationship?
Well, most people think Mack Wallace was a killer,
right,
who killed people for Johnson and for Billy Saul Estes and that whole crowd. And I looked at it and I decided I don't know anything, so I'm going to look. And I found out that he was a liberal young fellow who was an outstanding student at the University of Texas. And Johnson liked to pick out people like that and come to his office to work for him. And Mack Wallace was only one of many. Another one is Bill Moyer, whom we know.
Oh, yeah.
Many. John Connolly was.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One. Judge Lloyd Hand, there was a whole bunch of those guys, and they were all usually at the University of Texas. And so this myth then was created by Billy Solestes, who was a petty criminal, and he was finally caught in various scams. I won't go into all these scams, but with cotton allotments and fertilizer, he's trying to corner the market and fertilizer and whatnot. And he was paying off Johnson. Johnson got, how do you get cotton allotments? You and I cannot call up and say, we have a storage place, send us some cotton. Or send us some grain. They were storing grain also. And he had his storage facilities were full. And he got a huge amount of money for this. Wow. So, anyway, when Billy Solestes was caught, he saw Johnson would protect him. And Johnson distanced himself fast.
Yeah.
And so Billy Solestes went to jail. And when Billy Solestes got out after a second term in jail, 1984 or 5, and he decided, they went to a grand jury, and he accused Lyndon Johnson of organizing the murder of a person who worked for the Agriculture Department called Henry Marshall, and that Mack Wallace was hired by Johnson to kill Henry Marshall. Henry Marshall was murdered, and so were several people who had worked for Billy Solestes. No, Marshall did not work for Billy Solestes. He was the one who was going to finger him, who was going to report him to the Department of Agriculture. And then Mack Wallace was then accused of many other murders. He was even accused by Billy Solestes of killing Johnson's sister.
Right, yeah.
And others, and Kennedy. Then to top it all off, it would be Kennedy. And they had, and it turned out one of these zealous researchers, who was sincere, his name was Jay Harrison, got a bee in his bonnet that Mack Wallace, that there's one unidentified fingerprint that was found at the Texas School Book Depository. And it was in the hands of the Warren Commission. They got it from the FBI on the day of the Kennedy assassination. A left little finger. And Jay got the idea that Mack Wallace. And so he hired a forensic examiner to look at the fingerprint and look at Mack Wallace. Mack Wallace, I should add, killed somebody in the 1950s, sort of a crime of passion, a golf professional named Kinzer, and his fingerprints were taken by the Austin Police Department, and he had also, Mack Wallace in 1939, had joined the Marines, and they take your fingerprint, the Navy takes your fingerprints when you join, so but Jay didn't have the Navy. I finally got the Navy prints. You can only get those after X number of years pass, and they hadn't passed for him, but they did for me. And the Austin prints were a little bit blurred because they didn't clean off the machine from the previous perpetrator. So it was a little blurry. And the examiner, an elderly man at the time, was convinced it was Maxwell. So when I started this story, I figured, well, what I'm going to do is start this investigation all over again. And I found it on the internet a forensic examiner, fingerprint examiner, who turned out, I didn't know this at the time, was an officer in the certifying organization. It's an organization that certifies fingerprint examiners. And he came to my house, believe it or not. He also had worked for the New Jersey police and as a crime scene investigator. And he came here and he said, so I gave him the Navy prints and I gave him the Austin prints. And then he said, I had the prints from Jay that were from, the Austin prints were from Jay. And then I got the print from the Warren Commission from the National Archives. And the FBI does fantastic prints, very clear. And I called and they said the National Archives sent me a photograph, which was pristine. So now my examiner looks at these, he looks at the Navy, he looks at the Austin, and he looks at the one from the National Archives. And he says, the one from the Navy and the one from Austin are of the same person, but this one from the Texas Depository is not that person. So can you imagine, everybody went ballistic, because all the cases, all these books that you've mentioned certain authors of,
yeah,
their thesis that Johnson was involved in the Kennedy assassination and was using Mack Wallace came from that fingerprint identification. Now, the fingerprint is no good. So what happens to all those books? Goodbye.
Yeah.
I wasn't out for those people. But they're very sloppy, see, and that was what we were talking about earlier, about these investigations and how they're corrupted and sloppy and make up things and so forth. Well, it's not my fault. And by the way, I have to say, when I found that, I had been talking to Mack Wallace's children, grown up now, of course, his son and daughter, especially his son. And when I was able to tell his son that that wasn't his father's print in the school book depository, it made me happy. Because he always said that his father had been home on the day of the Kennedy assassination, and the kid was very upset because he thought it was a black mark against Texas. They were from Texas. And so his father tried to console him. So his father, his father's, nobody's a saint. His father had committed that murder I mentioned, but he did not kill President Kennedy in any way, or was not involved in any way in that. And he was happy. So then I called my publisher. Very funny. And I'm excited because I think I've discovered something. Doesn't matter what you discover, where the truth lies, that's where you go. But I was so happy. The publisher was down. He was not happy at all because he thought a much more interesting book that you have a murderer of President Kennedy.
Yeah.
And I couldn't say I did.
No. Well, what did you learn? But did you think that... because he was known as such a, like the hitman for Johnson. Do you think there's any truth to that at all?
No.
No.
Now, he did do some jobs for Johnson. He did some, which I found in this is what I did. I found the archives of Life magazine. Life magazine, and then around the time of maybe 1964, 65, maybe it was before Johnson became president, so it must have been 62, 63. They wanted to do an expose of Johnson and all his corruption. So they had one of their writers was called Holland McCombs. Ironically, later, who tried to disturb the Garrison investigation, because he was connected to CIA, believe it or not. But at this time, he was with Life magazine, and he went in the hinterland of Texas to try to find out the truth about Johnson. And one of the things he found was that Johnson had a young man named Mack Wallace who would do some jobs for him. Like Johnson, if he give you a government loan and then you have to give him a kickback from that, or maybe you have to give him part of your business. And so Mack Wallace went into the hinterland of Texas to collect for Johnson. He did that. And that doesn't mean he killed anybody or President Kennedy or anything else. He just did jobs for Johnson. He had been out of work. He had worked as a teacher, as a professor at various universities. And he lost his jobs, all the jobs, and so he went back to McWallace. He went back to Texas, and he ran into Cliff Carter, who was Johnson's right-hand man in Texas, and Cliff Carter brought him to Washington to work for the Department of Agriculture and for Johnson. And among the other jobs that McWallace did was sort of to look after his sister, Josepha, because she was very wild and she was promiscuous, and Johnson, and not only McWallace, but also Horace Busby, who was the editor of the Daily Texan at the time that McWallace was a student at the University of Texas. Somebody wrote a little thing about my book, and they said, oh, there's too much about McWallace at the University of Texas. My favorite part of the book, one of my favorites. Because here we see this young man who was just trying to make his way, became president of the student body, which is a big thing in Texas. And he threw himself into the movement to restore the Board of Trustees, and the governor of Texas, who was Coke Stevenson at the time, fired the president of the University of Texas, whose name was Homer Rainey, and who was a liberal and a believer in the views of John Dewey and all this. And McWallace organized the student body to protest this and to demand that Homer Rainey be reinstated. And the trustees were all picked by Coke Stevenson, all reactionaries, and he never got reinstated. But that was what McWallace, he gave a speech at a football game at Southern Methodist University, which is in Dallas. And isn't it in Dallas? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, maybe they were playing at Austin. They were playing at Texas Stadium. They were not playing in, so they were playing in Austin. And during halftime, McWallace gets up, and the whole crowd is there, you know, the place is full, and he stands and gives a speech for Homer Rainey. And everybody was in tears. Homer Rainey was in tears. And it was, I think, the finest moment of his life. And I wanted to convey that. That was a high point of his life. And then after that, hard times came. He lost the woman that he loved, because he was from a poor family. That's the truth. She admitted it to me at the age of 90. And he loved her till the day he died. I know that, because he talked to his wife, the wife he had now in California when he went there, and she said he kept talking about the woman named Carol Ann. A woman named Carol Ann. Now, this woman that he loved in the University of Texas was called Nora Ann Carroll. Pretty close.
Yeah.
And he always talked about her. He lost the thing that meant the most to him. So I think it's an interesting story. And I wanted it to stand for Johnson's relationships with all similar young men whom he corrupted, whom he used. And there are many, many books about that. Like what was his name? Eric. One of the historians who went to work for Johnson said he took those young men and he destroyed their lives, because he used them and he made them do whatever he wanted, whatever jobs he had, whatever he was doing. And he had some dillies.
Yes.
And one of them even involved a treasure trove in New Mexico.
Oh.
And it was found old Mexican gold and Spanish gold and whatnot. And he got involved with that and started carting away the gold bars that were there. And I found the people that did the research on that on the ground, and they have affidavits, everything. So this is a corrupt figure beyond what anybody knows. And then, of course, there's Johnson's role in the USS Liberty.
Right.
Because, and if you read that part, if you had a chance, when, the ship is being fired on, they manage, because the Navy were very smart, very competent. The Navy are fabulous. So they manage to get a hooked up, you know, in the attack, all the antenna were destroyed. But one sailor managed to get one cable going, and they sent out an SOS to the Sixth Fleet. And the people and the ships in the Sixth Fleet could hear the shots, the rockets fired against them. So now, some of these admirals, like they're from Joseph Conrad novel, they're extremely sincere, sympathetic. So one of these admirals on the USS Saratoga, he he just immediately hears that SOS, and he launches, I don't know how many, it was four or five planes, to go to the site of the Liberty. Now, the other ship, which was the USS America, did not launch, and that's a story that sort of exposes an admiral that's involved in this crime, the conspiracy. So, of course it's a conspiracy. And they have to tell McNamara that they've done it. So that they launched the planes. They did. So McNamara calls back on an open line, no less, and says, "Call back those planes." So the admiral thinks McNamara mistook a thought that maybe nuclear arms were sent, and he relaunched planes that could not possibly have a nuclear component. And then McNamara calls back. I said, "Call back those planes." And the admiral's angry now, and he says, "I don't have to listen to this." You know, and McNamara is not an elected. He's appointed by Johnson. He wasn't elected even. So then Jack Johnson, whose voice is distinctive, you can't miss it, grabs the telephone and says, "Call back those planes. I won't embarrass my allies." Your allies? Those ships were black. Those planes were blacked over. You couldn't tell whose plane they were. Only all identifying marks were covered, which is a violation of international law, by the way. And call back those planes. And that was it. They called back. Johnson's the commander-in-chief. So once he says, "Call back the planes," all the admirals, whomever, they have to call back the planes, and they did. And then the people on the ship were left alone without any help, without any aid. One doctor for 300 people for 17 hours until the next morning when the USS America and the Saratoga and other ships went to the site. That's murder.
Yeah.
That's Johnson is a war criminal. Nobody ever talks about this. I don't know. This part of Johnson's life has not appeared in the Robert Carroll biographies yet. He hasn't covered 1967 yet. Let's see what he does.
Yeah. Well, so your overall impression, it's still not necessarily real rosy about Lyndon Johnson.
Ha ha. Very funny, right?
Yeah.
I'm not even interested in Lyndon Johnson, frankly. Yeah. Who is it? In the greater scheme of things, we got real trouble.
Yeah.
And he's no one that we want to be proud of. I'm not giving him credit for any of the great society, because once the Vietnam War, went in full flight, then they had to just cut back the money on all those programs. So goodbye to the great society, as Martin Luther King noted. King had no use for Johnson. Finally, when Johnson asked Dr. King to come and attend when the Voting Rights Act was signed, he refused to go.
Yeah.
Which is a moment of integrity, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
And besides, the civil rights that we got were the work of people that were in the civil rights movement. Dr. King, Malcolm X, Robert Moses, all those people that in SNCC that risked their lives for voting rights.
Why do they promote Johnson as such a civil rights leader?
Well, they want to, it's a question of promoting the figure of power, the figure that's part of the system, the figure that they could then cover, they could cover themselves. I don't think he gave it, and I have a lot in my book, I don't think he gave a damn about civil rights.
Yeah.
So, they promote, and I think the biographers, and there are several, really are giving him cover. They're providing cover for somebody, because, you see, you don't want to undermine the faith of the population in the government. Well, see what that has resulted in?
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
The current situation. But isn't it better to admit the truth of what's going on, when it's happening? Such, whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly. You can't deal with it if you don't talk about it.
And then we could put it in its proper place. Johnson is disgusting. He's maybe the worst person ever in the office to date.
Yeah, that might change.
But terrible.
Yeah.
And the Vietnam, unspeakable. He made a deal. And it's well known. He admitted it. when he was, you know, when President Kennedy was killed, Johnson told the Joint Chiefs, which is an office, not a person, let me get elected, because Johnson had to get elected right away in 1964. Let me get elected, and I'll give you your war. So he knew that he was put in there to give the war, make the war, create the war, which he did. And the whole country, I mean, that maybe people didn't know what was what, but they sure knew, they placed the blame on him. I remember, if I may say so, that he couldn't walk out in the street, he couldn't go to a building, a public building, without demonstrators being outside with signs. Wow. He would sneak. I was once demonstrating in Des Moines. And there he is, and his wife, and the two beautiful daughters, and they had to sneak in the side door.
Wow.
So we was because Vietnam was unspeakable.
Yeah. It's terrible. You know, who do you respect in the JFK genre of writing? Good information.
You got me there.
Well, I mean, has there been anybody else you've come across? Like, you go to the meetings there in November and...
God.
Yeah. But
there are some people, I shouldn't say that, there are some people that have done very interesting work. I very much respected Mark Lane.
Right.
But I knew Mark Lane, and I remember when he first came out at the time of the Kennedy assassination, and he rented a church in New York City called the Jan Hus Church, and he would just talk about the inconsistencies in the stories that were being told about what happened. It couldn't happen that way, and he had talked to witnesses, and he sacrificed his political career for that. Now, he was very egocentric. Maybe some of these people are, but that's neither. Who's perfect? Who isn't?
Right.
So, you know, but he did. I think he did great work. And his work on E. Howard Hunt and that case that he did, and it came out in a book called Plausible Denial.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think he was exceptional. He was a credit to the research.
Yeah. He was another one that kind of got slammed a lot, too, wasn't he? So.
Well, yeah, he was on the list.
Yeah.
The list of people to be attacked. So that's the kind of person that I also like very much, and you would be interested if you haven't had him on, and that is Bob Tannenbaum. Bob Tannenbaum was a prosecutor in New York City in Frank Hogan's office, and he then became the deputy counsel for the House Select Committee investigating the Kennedy assassination. Totally honest, interested in what was going on, looking into the Garrison case. And by the way, another person whom I admired very much, also gone, Bob is alive, but Gayton Funzie was the researcher for the House Select Committee. And he had all the prejudices against Garrison that you're supposed to have. And then he went to New Orleans, and he did a long interview with Garrison, which is available from the National Archives on tape. And he just changed his mind completely. And another person who changed her mind and I liked was Mary Farrell, who was a great scholar of the Warren Report. And she, too, she hated Garrison. She made fun of Garrison. But then she realized and what he went through and that he was right. It took a lot of people time before they could register what had happened.
And
most of the people I have are not honest. They're just not.
Right. And do you have a thought on the Warren Commission?
No, because I think it was just set up. My thought is that you should never have a government investigation. And so all these people on the USS Liberty that have been begging for a government investigation for 50 years are crazy. Because all they have to do is look at the Warren Commission, and they could see that it was all set up with Alan Dulles at the helm, and appointed by Johnson, and that they never told the truth about anything. And one of the things that they did, the big thing that they didn't tell, was that Lee Harvey Oswald was sent by the CIA into the Soviet Union as a decoy, setting him up. And they would never grant that, you know, and that's the case. Anybody who studies this comes to know that. You can see it in New Orleans. So Garrison was looking, and he saw Oswald with Clay Shaw, who was CIA, as I mentioned. They said he was highly paid. Highly paid. and also with David Ferry, who was a pilot for CIA, and was the three of them together, traveling around Louisiana.
Yeah.
And Oswald is set up to try to get a job at the East Louisiana State Hospital at Jackson. And then it turned out that the doctor, the medical director of the hospital, his name was Frank Silva, whom Garrison never got to interview, believe it or not. But anyway, that was a flaw in his investigation. It wasn't perfect. And I saw, I got to meet Frank Silva, a wonderful man, Cuban, came to the U.S. before the Castro. And he said, he passed by a room where Oswald is sitting, holding forth, you know, about how he's going to kill Castro, and he's going to use his Marine Corps talents and skills, and you know, talking loud. Well, Dr. Silva walks by the door, and hears this, and he thinks to himself, there's no way that man is going to get a job in my hospital. So he thwarts the CIA's plan, because what Garrison thought was, oh, they were going to hire Oswald. There's no doubt about that. He applied and everything. And then they maybe find out that they think he was a patient, not a worker, and he'd be a patient there, and then he'd escape. So we have an escapee from the insane asylum in Louisiana turn up in Dealey Plaza. And then they could say that this insane person shot President Kennedy, the lone assassin. Only it didn't work out that way. But that was part of the framing of Oswald. Nothing to do with Texas.
Yeah.
So yeah. That was very interesting. Garrison, a big discovery of Garrison.
Yeah, for sure. Well.
So I'm proud of Garrison.
Yeah.
You ask me about Garrison, yeah. And I talk about it, I realize. I feel so sorry for Garrison, and I appreciate him, and I appreciate how hard he tried to do this. And nobody, no other public official in the whole history of the United States did what he did here in trying to adjudicate the Kennedy assassination in a court of law. Court of law, it's supposed to be like that. You're supposed to put people on trial.
Yeah.
And if somebody is a collaborator, like Clay Shaw, which he was, then he's supposed to be under arrest and in jail. And so that's what Garrison tried to do.
Well,
now, Oswald didn't shoot Kennedy. Yeah. He was the decoy. He was the person that they framed
right.
to.
Yeah.
But still, Shaw participated in that. That's participating, you know, that's an overt act in the conspiracy law.
Yeah, sure, certainly. Wow. This has been a real pleasure having you on. And,
for now, I like to talk to you.
Yeah, and we're kind of out of time now. But so your newest book out right now is called The Faustian Bargains, and that's Lyndon Johnson and Mac Wallace in the Robber Baron Culture of Texas. And we have it linked on our site as well, and of course you can get it from any major bookstore or Amazon, or you can go to Joan Mellon's website, joanmellon.com. Thanks for being on the show, Joan.
Thank you, Al.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.